It's running.
Hello, hi, I'm Helen Henley, Health Optimization Coach, and I'm delighted to be here with Elwyn Robinson, founder of Lionheart Herbs, creator of Health Coaching Institute, the Complete Detox Academy, High Energy Academy, and author of The Easy Exhausting Cure. So today we're going to learn about autumn and what food to eat and how to support our lung system during these cold, damp months. So, foods have a particular energy in Chinese medicine. So what I'd really like to do is to get Elwyn to explain how we can pick and choose the correct foods to support the energy of these months. So Elwyn, are you up for that?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, let's go for it.
Fantastic. Okay, so Elwyn, can you tell us what and explain why, what the energy of the autumn months is and how that can affect us?
Absolutely, yeah. So just to explain, the idea behind this is from a Taoist point of view, right, this ancient Chinese system from which acupuncture and Chinese herbalism and Kung Fu comes from, that one. So from a Taoist point of view, each of the seasons corresponds to a particular organ system, which includes the usually a couple of organs or more, as well as different systems throughout the body. So we don't have time here to do like a complete overview of the whole system. We go through that very thoroughly in the Taoist Health Academy program. But for now, we can just say that at this time of year, which we're recording this, autumn, the correspondence is to the lung organ system, which also includes particularly the large intestine. And so these are organs more than anything of elimination. And so autumn is a good time to kind of release and let go of a lot of things. So whereas in the summer we've been building up a lot of energy, right, and feeling pretty energized by the sun, by the increased daylight, all that kind of thing. As autumn comes in, it's time to kind of unwind that energy a little bit more. Autumn, by the way, is fall for all our American friends who aren't familiar with that terminology. It's time to unwind a lot of that energy and kind of just calm down and relax a little bit more. So it's an inward going energy. And so there's all kinds of different things we can say for that energy. For instance, it's dry and cold, or cool at least, maybe not cold, drying and cooling. And so we want to be aware, especially at this time of year that corresponds to the lungs and large intestine, we're most likely or more likely at this time of year than any other time of year to experience problems with those areas, with those organ systems, with our lungs and with our large intestine. Now, the lung thing is especially noticeable, right? You go around in autumn, you speak to people, everyone's got a cold, right? Not everyone, but, you know, a lot of people are having colds, flus, those kind of symptoms. And so we relate this to the lung organ system needing to be extra looked after at this time of year especially. And so there's numerous things you can do with that. We'll be exploring actually over several interviews. But today we thought we'd focus on eating, right? What we can do, what foods actually nourish and support the lung organ system. And then we'll hopefully get a few herbs in there as well, because the line between tonic herbs and foods is fairly slim.
Hmm. So, Elwyn, is there a particular sort of formula that you can use to sort of identify, say if you're going into the supermarket or your organic farm shop or wherever, is there certain things you should be looking for? Is there a way you can easily identify some items of food that are good to support your lung system?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. First of all, very simply, white foods, believe it or not. Now, obviously, just got to explain that for a second. I'm not talking about white sugar or white flour or anything like that, right? I'm talking about foods that are naturally white. So, for instance, probably a classic example, garlic, right? This is a classic lung food for another reason, which I'll explain in a second. But, you know, that's naturally white, right? If you look at it. Or a white onion. A potato as well, right? At least on the inside. Depends. Some are more yellow, some are even black, but generally like a white potato. These kind of foods are naturally white, so this would correspond to the lung organ system. And also kind of a lettuce, maybe like an iceberg lettuce, the kind of light colored lettuces. These might, I mean, they're a little bit green, but they're also kind of white. These would kind of correspond to it as well. And this is probably the more important category, it's the flavor. And so the flavor is pungent foods, pungent. And so what does pungent mean? Kind of basically means spicy, right? So your garlic, ginger, chili, onion, mustard, even watercress. These kind of foods, what they all have in common is they have this pungent, and it's got a kind of dispersing quality. So what does that mean? Well, have you ever been in a situation where maybe your nose is feeling kind of blocked, and then you have a meal with a lot of spicy food, like a lot of chili, and you notice that mucus, that blockage starts to move very quickly, right? Maybe you notice that actually your whole skin, which corresponds also to the lung organ system, starts to sweat, right? So this is dispersing. This is kind of blockages, any kind of dampness and stuckness, especially relating to phlegm and mucus, as well as, you know, with the skin, just moving out of your body, moving out of your body. So it's getting stuff moving. And, of course, you may well notice maybe the morning after eating a food, high in spicy food, going to the toilet is not difficult, you know, if you have a tendency towards constipation. Suddenly it's all moving down there as well. And so these kind of pungent foods have a justified reputation for getting stuff moving and encouraging release, encouraging stuff moving out of you, especially stuckness moving out of you. So pungent quality of foods as well. And of course, garlic, like I mentioned, that's probably like a classic one because it's both white and pungent. So it fits into both categories very nicely.
That's really interesting because I guess in the autumn or the fall, during the summer, we've just been sort of being really sort of yang and putting ourselves out there and doing lots of things. And so I guess, does the energy change in the autumn to
absolutely
skin?
Absolutely, yeah. So during the spring, we've got the kind of onrush of yang energy, the onrush of extroverted outgoing energy relating to the liver. Then during the summer, we've got kind of the peak of the yang energy relating to the heart, where we're really experiencing it. And then so next, we've got autumn, fall. And so this is the onrush of the yin energy and the receding of the yang energy. So the days get shorter, right? There's less light, there's less sun, the temperature goes down, there's less dryness, more moisture in the atmosphere, right? And so this is a more yin time of year. And so, as always on the Tao system, we want to align ourselves with nature. We don't want to fight it. We don't want to pretend it's not happening. We don't want to be like, oh, God, you know, autumn's here. I'm so upset about that. That's not going to help us. But on the other hand, we also want to just understand and go with it in the same way that a surfer rides a wave and understand, okay, this is what's happening now. And so we want to be in alignment with that, and we want to support our body in that. Mm-hmm. And so just as an example, you know, during the summer months, you've got this heat, this yang energy, and so, you know, it's very good to eat more raw foods, more salad-y foods, more green foods, maybe more fruits as well, if your body can, you know, deal with that well, because all of these things are cooling, right? And so if we were to take that exact same strategy and bring it into autumn, if our body is very, very yang all the time, then that might still be good for us to have that kind of diet. But if it's not, if our body's more kind of in the middle, more centered, or maybe more on the other side, maybe we're more naturally yin in our body, maybe we're more naturally cold, more naturally damp, then to eat that kind of diet of cold, damp foods primarily or exclusively, from this Taoist perspective and really from my practical perspective as well. And, you know, for everyone listening right now, just because I said it doesn't mean it's true, right? I don't expect you to believe anything I'm saying. But I am saying that, you know, I've tried a lot of different things. This approach is not the one that I thought I would end up, like, living by, but it's the one that I have because it's worked, you know? And for so many people who I found, if the approach actually works, because it's not based on an idea, like all people should eat like our ancestors did, you know, the paleo thing, or, you know, all people should eat just more food like our ancient ancestors did, or, you know, all people should eat this or that. It's not based on that. It's based on a kind of just an alignment with an awareness of the seasons and what that does to our own body and what that does to the energy. And so what works best for that? So to have maybe less foods, which are very yin, very cold and very damp, and more foods which are heating and dispersing. Now, just to clarify that, it doesn't have to be an either-or proposition, right? So, for instance, if you're someone who just loves having a lot of juices, right, then, I mean, they are quite cold and damp as a general point, but, of course, we can kind of make them more suitable for these autumn or fall months by changing some of the content. Right, so if we start adding some ginger, start adding some chili, maybe start adding some garlic, maybe adding some fennel, maybe adding some watercress, maybe adding some foods which are pungent, then we're still having the juice like we want, but we are kind of aligning ourselves with the season a little bit more by supporting the lung organ system.
And you can do that with your salads and your dressing. You can put radishes in and ginger in your salad dressing. So, as you say, there is a way to adapt around this if it's the way that you like to eat. I remember
you saying, Elwin,
that digestion takes up, like, so much of our available energy. And what I'm wondering is, because in the autumn we need a lot of our energy to keep warm, to eliminate and do all these sort of things that autumn energy requires, then if digestion is taking up a lot of that energy, I guess we may be, if we haven't got a really strong digestion, making things unnecessarily hard for ourselves. Is there a way that we can eat and support our digestion that it is in alignment with the autumn energy?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, there's lots to say about digestion, but I'll just pick, like, maybe the most important and relevant points for this interview. So when we think about digestion and we're thinking about the lung organ system, we really think first and foremost about the large intestine, right? And so most of us are in a position where we're constipated. Now, maybe not most people listening to this, I'm not sure, but a surprising amount of people who are in the vegan world, the vegetarian world, the raw food world, the eating healthily despite eating animal foods world, you know, all these very valid worlds, a surprising number of them still come to me and say that they have this issue with not going to the toilet frequently enough, or they don't know that they have an issue with it, but when actually quizzed, they realize they have an issue with it because maybe they only go once a day, and, you know, that's not very often. The natural amount of time is to go to the toilet is amount of times over bowel movement is about once every meal, right? So I'm not saying literally during the meal, but I'm saying, you know, if you have three meals a day, then having three bowel movements a day is perfectly reasonable, right? And only having one probably means that you're blocked to some degree. So this is true all the time. This is something that's important to understand and look at all the time, but it's especially important at this time of year again, because we're more likely to have that kind of blockage, that kind of constipation, than other times of the year. So to really be aware of that. Now, I can give you a list of foods which will tend to constipate you and not constipate you. You know, so generally fruits and vegetables, and I guess pulses as well, kind of beans. These are quite famous for getting the digestion moving and not getting stuck in your system. There are exceptions to that. I mean, even like bananas, for instance, potatoes, probably a little bit blocking. But that's the kind of general rule. Whereas foods like meats, dairy, grains, also nuts, these have a tendency more to be blocking, to be constipating. And so to be aware of that and to just be aware of those general principles, but then really just to notice, like within your own body, what is it that leaves me feeling blocked or constipated? And what is it that means I have those kind of, you know, smooth, easy bowel movements? And because for you, there may be exceptions, you know. Like, for some people, I know avocado is really good for them. For other people, I know they, you know, as soon as they have an avocado with their lunch or whatever, then they know they're going to be more blocked, right? And so everyone's different in this regard. So it's about finding out which foods block you, finding out which foods allow you to have that clear digestion. I'd say that's the number one issue. And, you know, if this is an issue for you, especially constipation is an issue for you, if digestion is an issue for you, like, I would really prioritize. I'm going to eat foods which keep me moving, and I'm going to avoid foods which block me up. That's a real priority. And for all kinds of reasons, you know, so many of us, God, so many people I've come across, like, when they say they're in, you know, they're upset, they're in a mood, they're angry, or they're depressed, they're listless, they're demotivated, they don't have any energy, right? When quizzed, they'll realize, oh, I'm blocked up. I haven't had a bowel movement, you know? And as soon as they either successfully have a bowel movement, or maybe they have an enema, or they have a colonic, then suddenly they feel better. It's like a huge relief. So this is something that isn't just like because it's because Elwin said so, or because of some theory textbook thing. This is something that will impact and affect your quality of life immediately. The difference between you constipated and blocked and you, you know, clearly having everything go through you without any blockages in terms of your quality of life, your relationships, your clarity of mind, your energy, your feeling of confidence, all of these kind of things are intimately related. So, you know, as much as whatever it is that you know blocks you might taste good, it's not as important as all of this. So, yeah, that's the big thing. You know, make that a priority, and by all means, add pungent foods in. Not all of them agree with all people. Some people's bodies, garlic disagrees with them. Some people's bodies, chili disagrees with them. Personally, in my body, anything other than a small amount of ginger disagrees with me. My body finds it too heaty. But, you know, so, you know, just again, just because someone says it's good doesn't mean it's going to be good for you. You've got to try it. But add some of these pungent foods in to help your body to kind of keep moving. For me, chili is awesome. You know, I have cayenne pepper powder every day in water. I have it in food as well as often as I can. That's really good to keep me moving, as well as it has all kinds of other benefits as well, health benefits. There's all kinds of other issues of constipation, obviously. You need to have enough exercise. You need to have enough water, hydration. You need to be allow yourself to relax and not be too stressed. That's probably the biggest factor of all. But in terms of what we eat, this is really important as well.
Yeah, and to have it at the forefront of your mind, because I've had clients who realize that they haven't been to the toilet for, you know, quite a long time. And sometimes, because I guess your clarity goes, you don't actually realize. And as Elwin said, you go into a state of confusion that is released instantly when you actually do go to the toilet. So it's massively important. So would you suggest as well, so you said that roots and pulses, they're really good to eat to keep you moving. They're also some of the foods that the Taoist system would encourage you to eat at this time. Is there a way to sort of cook them?
Yeah, so fruits and vegetables and pulses, particularly the category of the food, I would say, keeps you moving. So, yeah, I mean, roots would go in with vegetables. As I said, maybe white potatoes, not for everyone, can definitely block some people. Some people, their bodies object to the solanine, which is an alkaloid in potatoes. So, you know, everyone is different again. But, yeah, generally those are good categories. So, yeah, I mean, this is going to be maybe a little bit of a shocking statement to some people. But
go on,
then. I mean, this time of year, yeah, so we're talking about root vegetables. It's kind of baking, stews, casseroles, you know, this is this kind of year, like a baked potato or, a, you know, white potatoes don't agree with you, like a baked sweet potato, baked parsnips, this kind of thing, right? This would be the kind of food, stews, casseroles, you know, something that's warm, something that's not just warm because it's not just a matter of kind of, you know, putting it in a pan, heating up like a soup, like something really that's been immersed in heat. That's the kind of thing that the Taoists would particularly recommend at this time of year. As I say, not going to be popular with everyone. I don't think that necessarily, like, I'm not a big fan of doing anything that damages food, right? Like, I was a raw fooder for years, and I'm still really into this thing of, you know, to especially with fats, make sure that you don't damage the fat, right? So I would not recommend to anyone to eat nuts or seeds, for instance, which are being roasted in the oven, or which have been, you know, grilled or baked or whatever. So I think we do want to be careful with this. But if we're talking about adding a stew, maybe with some onions, some garlic, some chili, some beans, maybe some root vegetables, right? Really going for all these categories which we've shared here. So, you know, maybe mixing that together on the stove and then putting a lid on it and putting it in the oven for half an hour. You know, maybe meat, if you eat meat, maybe not. That kind of thing, that's what we're talking about. That's like really good this time of year food from a Taoist perspective.
Mm. And if you were going to sort of roast anything or bake anything, then you'd obviously use coconut oil. Would that be the best oil to use?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, if the taste of it was objectionable to you, you can use palm oil as well.
Okay.
That's kind of basically the same thing. It's like saturated fat, but it just doesn't taste very much. So we have that in the cupboard as well. We actually never use it because we like the taste of coconut oil, but we have it there in case there's something that, you know, we don't want the taste of coconut oil with. Then, I mean, you know, again, may not be popular with some people, but, you know, certainly if you're really like, oh, yeah, you know, I want to do this, but, you know, you don't want coconut oil or palm oil or whatever, then there is also animal fat, right? And, again, I personally don't use it, but, you know, for a lot of people, it's very beneficial. It was kind of, there was this whole campaign against it, you know, like 2 or 3 decades ago about how terrible it is for you. In excess, I would say this is still true. You know, it's inflammatory. Having large amounts of, I think it's called arachidonic acid, which is the stuff that you find in animal fat. So you wouldn't want large amounts of it, but a little bit of butter or a little bit of, you know, the fat that actually meat, you know, that comes from cooking meat to then roast your potatoes in or whatever, as would be traditional, that, you know, would be another way of doing it.
Mm. But you know what I found a few months ago, Elwin? It's a coconut oil that has sort of been steamed lightly, and they've taken the coconut flavor out of the coconut oil.
Okay.
So it's really, really good. So we use that if we're going to do anything that requires, you know, no coconut flavor. Or ghee is something that I've started using. What do you think about that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, ghee is just like an upgraded butter to me.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I believe is pretty much what it is. I mean, it's just, you know, the part of dairy which disagrees with people is either going to be the protein or the carbohydrate. So either like the lactose or the casein or, you know, whey, depending on which fraction. So ghee, like butter, is basically hardly any of that stuff but a bit of it, and ghee is significantly less of that stuff. So, you know, if that stuff bothers you, but you want to have the benefit of some, you know, maybe dairy fat, because that does feel nourishing for you, then ghee is perfect.
Okay, that's really awesome. So, something
else. And of course,
that
just
makes
to clarify, and if you make your own or if you get a good quality version and you talk about eating it raw, then it's also fermented food, which has some of those kind of benefits that we've talked about previously.
Okay. So, something that most people don't actually think of as food, but it's something that you mentioned at the start of the interview, and that is tonic herbs. Can you explain
Yes.
how you see those?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, if you fancy find an email, I'll try and find the link and put it in the email as well. But I've kind of done an explanation of this before, which is a bit more detailed. But, you know, just in summation, if we look at food on one end of the spectrum, like your everyday food or, you know, meat and potatoes or, you know, green veg and potatoes, whatever it is that it is for you, and then on the other end of the spectrum, we think of medicine, you know, like the type we have these days, you know, like take 2 pills at night, that kind of thing. We tend to think of herbs, and falsely, unfortunately, even tonic herbs, as being kind of on the spectrum nearer to, like, medicine than we do to food. And to be honest, people in our industry are partly responsible for this because they go around making all kinds of health claims, which are, of course, you know, true or largely true about all these health benefits that the food can give you. But we don't realize that actually tonic herbs, they're nowhere near the medicine category on the spectrum, right? They're way closer to the food end of the spectrum. Now, some herbs, like medicinal herbs that you may have heard of, like echinacea or St. John's Wort or that kind of thing, they actually are perhaps nearer to the medicine side, you know. They're things that you need to be careful of, don't take too often, take the right dose. But that's not tonic herbs, you know. In fact, like tonic herbs, if you go to like a Chinese supermarket, any Chinese supermarket of any size anyway, you'll see these little packets of soup mixes, like just, and they're basically just mixes of tonic herbs that you throw into soup. And so for them, it was never like, even though it had massively beneficial health effects, obviously, it was never meant to be considered to be like, you know, oh my God, I've got to worry about this, and, you know, have I got the right dosage and this kind of thing. It's just something that you throw into food, or that you make into a tea, obviously, and drink. So that's kind of the quick, you know, perspective of what tonic herbs are. They're something that's obviously massively beneficial, and, you know, that's covered many, many places, many, many times by me. But they're more food than they are medicine. Of course, there's a saying, let food be your medicine and medicine be your food. And so they're that kind of medicine, but they're not like, oh my God, I've got to worry about having an overdose. I've got to worry about, you know, is it suitable for me or not? They're not that kind of medicine. So what are the top herbs? Well, we could mention like a couple of white herbs. So one is pearl, right? So pearl is a like pure white powder. Now, pearl isn't an obvious one for the lungs, but it is for the skin, which is part of the lung organ system. So pearl is like an amazing beauty herb, has been used for that for thousands of years. It's becoming very popular. I'm noticing in the whole beauty industry now is a thing that you actually put in your skin. And so that's an option. Great for your teeth as well, brushing your teeth with pearl after you've like cleaned them with something that's more cleansing, or even adding it to the whatever you're using to brush your teeth with, if you want to be quick about it and just do brush them once. It's like really, really good. So it's a nourishing thing for the teeth. It's a nourishing thing for the skin, used internally or externally. It's a Shen herb, which means it's also calming, pacifying. It's full of minerals, so it's something that's really nourishing as well. So that's an example of a white herb that comes under this category. Another example might be poria. Poria is a mushroom, actually, a medicinal mushroom, comes under that category. Not so much a lung herb, although it has partly lung benefits, but it's also mainly a Shen herb and a spleen herb. So it's great for digestion, great for helping to calm the whole system. It is an immune system booster. Let's look at the main lung herbs for a second. So we've talked a lot about the large intestine. We're going to talk more about the lungs probably next week, because we're going to go through some other things to really benefit the lungs other than food. But as we're covering, you know, food for the lungs today, I've got to mention these herbs. Number one, my absolute favorite. It's not white, but it is a light color. And it's a fairly fairly pleasant taste, and it's called Ophiopogon. Qianmendong. No, Maimendong. Wow. But Ophiopogon. So Ophiopogon. Don't try and find the Chinese name on my site. It won't be there, but just for anyone who knows the Chinese. So Ophiopogon. It's a really, really powerful and really effective lung tonic. So good for the lungs, also good for the throat, really good for the voice. So if your lungs are feeling a little bit dry, and this is actually the main problem with the lungs, and often this goes unnoticed, and then that's where what I observe, then we're often later we'll get some kind of issue, like an actual illness. And then when you're ill, maybe you notice that there's phlegm or blockages, but it often starts with a dryness, right? That kind of dry, wheezy cough you may just notice, especially maybe you don't notice in normal life, but maybe when you're exerting yourself, maybe when you're running, you know, and you notice there's a kind of dryness in there. Well, that's an issue. That's from a Taoist point of view. The challenge of the lungs is that they become too cold, like if you're breathing cold air, especially if you're breathing it in through your mouth, and they become too dry. And so Ophiopogon is like a really powerful tonic herb to help to lubricate, moisten, and strengthen the lungs. Now, you may not notice that your lungs are dry, as I say, unless you're kind of quite in tune with them, but you might notice your throat is dry. You know, that's something that people notice quite often, right? Especially if you're speaking a lot. And this is something that especially happens, obviously, people who speak for a living, people who are on the phone all day, maybe customer service job, something like that. Speaking to people all day, face-to-face in a shop, whatever it might be. So if you're talking all day, you might want to see your throat gets dry, right? And so, again, that's a sign that the lungs are dry. And so having osteopogon on a regular basis, this is known as a herb which is great for singers, actors, you know, anyone, speakers, anyone whose profession especially depends on being able to use their voice in a powerful way, right? Osteopogon, brilliant. I've used it for exactly that purpose before. I've used it, given it to people who are singers, given it to people who are actors, and it's been amazing, right? So really highly recommend. And, of course, given it to people who are noticing any kind of cold, any kind of lung infection, any kind of anything like that, okay? So got to mention osteopogon, and I'll just mention one more, and that's astragalus, okay? I think I mentioned this in an email not long ago. It's like a great herb for this time of year, which absolutely is, because it's immune boosting, also again digestion strengthening. It's an energizing herb, really helps you adapt to the environment. So if you are feeling more cold than you were before, or if you're in a cold environment, or even the other way around, if you suddenly end up in a hot environment, it's really good at helping you adapt to that. So really recommend astragalus as well. It's one of the top tonic herbs in the world. Good thing about both osteopogon and astragalus is that the taste of them is quite mild. It's not like very bitter or anything like reishi. So they're quite easy to consume. And in fact, with both of them, you can make them into a tea, as I often do. But they can also be added to food. So again, if you're making that stew or if you're making that casserole, you can put like a teaspoon or two of these in a portion of whatever food it is that you're making. For yourself and eat it. And especially in the case of astragalus, it will actually help you digest the food better. So that's another way you can use these herbs. And then, of course, in the non-tonic category, I've already mentioned, you know, herbs, things like chili, things like garlic, things like ginger, things that help to disperse stuck or blockage of energy, especially damp, phlegm, mucus in the body.
Yeah, so I wanted to go back to something that you mentioned, which was this dryness, and you were talking about the skin being connected to the lung organ system. And I'm just sort of came to me that, you know, during the winter, this is one thing that people really suffer from, these chapped lips, this dry skin. So taking these herbs, would that help stop that occurring so much? Or is there something
absolutely
else you could add?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. Yeah, that's completely correct. They're all connected. So you're right. Like a lot of people, again, they don't notice the dryness in their lungs. Maybe they're not connected to their lungs, but they may well notice it in their skin. And so, yes, absolutely. Those herbs, I think, yeah, there's no change in that. I'd still recommend them. Yeah, absolutely. And same for constipation. We don't tend to think of constipation as a dryness issue, but it is. You know, if we were lubricated enough in those intestines, the food would keep moving through. So it's all the dryness issue, whether it's dry skin, whether it's dry lungs, whether it's a dry large intestine. That is the main challenge with this channel, dryness and then cold as well. And so that's like a chapped lips, right? That's a classic thing where you go outside, maybe it's very cold, and then your lips become dry, right? There's a connection there in practice.
Yeah, absolutely. So would you increase things like essential fatty acids as well and foods that contain those in the fall? Would that help the dryness as well?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the thing about the herbs, which we kind of maybe miss in the modern world, is that they're not like a substitute for having they're not going to be a substitute for having the nutrients that you need. You know, so in kind of the olden days, in brackets, for everyone other than maybe the poorest who just weren't able to afford food, most people would eat this, you know, kind of highly nutritious, relatively to today, food, right? And so they would not suffer from these deficiencies, and they would live a far more, despite any kind of problems, they had a far less overstimulated lifestyle than we have here, so they were far less depleted and all kinds of basic things. So, you know, in the olden days, you know, pretty much if someone was ill, they were either just given, in this Chinese kind of system, they were either given herbs or acupuncture, or usually both, and it worked. Because, you know, the only problem really was that there was some kind of imbalance of energy, maybe some kind of, ultimately that was the only problem. Even if there was some kind of infection of some kind of very real pathogen, it would still be the fact that the body's unbalanced, which means that the immune system isn't strong enough to fend it off. That's the root problem, right? So that's it. But in our modern day, we have a lot more challenges than just that. We've got this excess of toxicity. We've got deficiency of nutrients, right? We've got the overstimulated lifestyle, lack of connection to nature, things like fresh air, sunlight, grounding. Mm. All of those things are important. So absolutely, essential fatty acids, so EPA and DHA, omega-3s in general, also saturated fats, though, right, which we already talked about, like the coconut oil, having it internally, putting on the skin. Now, different people, it's going to be different for some people, especially people whose liver is quite overburdened. And a lot of the time, people who have issues with their lungs have issues with their liver as well, because if your lungs are not releasing properly, then the thing that kind of where the buck stops, the thing that takes the brunt of all that waste building up that the lungs aren't properly releasing, is the liver. So the liver is overloaded, in my experience, at least 8 times out of 10, because the lungs are not able to do their job. So if the liver is overloaded, then having a lot of extra fat, especially bulk fat, I mean, having some fish oil, having some EPA and DHA, some essential fats is probably going to be a good idea no matter what. And I highly recommend it. But having a lot of extra fat, or just having extra fat, if your liver's already a bit overloaded, you do need to be a little bit careful with. So with that one caveat, yes, more fats generally tend to be good to help the skin from becoming too dry.
Yeah, because what I love about all this is that when you see us as completely interconnected, you know, we're not... Our lungs aren't separate from the rest of us, from our emotions, from the state of our skin. It's a really good marker so that you can go out and if you think, oh, my lungs are perfectly fine, but you look and your skin's dry, you've got chapped lips, you've got a bit of a dry cough, all these things that we think are part and parcel of the change of season, they're actually indications that our organ system needs supporting, nourishing, or is slightly out of balance.
And I'll add to that, like you go to the toilet once a day or less and think that that's okay. Mm. That's another thing that often we don't even realise how much of an issue it is.
Yeah, so would you also recommend eating in season, Elwyn? Is that something that you think is very important?
I think it's quite important. That's probably not like a very Taoist perspective. That's my personal perspective. I mean, I guess the Taoists kind of didn't have a perspective on this because when all these Tao systems were being made, there was no other option. I mean, you pretty much ate seasonally. That was it. One of the things that's kind of seasonal, which I'll just, you know, mention for a second. At this time of year, I mean, maybe not now. We're recording this at the beginning of October. So some kind of, you know, salad stuff is still available in season. But especially, you know, as we get closer and closer to winter, maybe November, December time, there's less and less kind of salad. And so the traditional thing to do would be to eat fermented foods, right? So you take the foods from the summer, ferment them, and then eat them in the winter. So that's kind of a version of eating seasonally, where we're eating foods that may not be available at that time of year, but nonetheless, we're eating them. And that is traditional. That's something that, you know, goes back thousands of years. So there's kind of exceptions to the whole seasonal thing. So just because you can't find it, like, growing on a tree right now doesn't mean that it's not seasonal. I will just point that out. There are, like, ways of preserving things and you know, keeping them around. I mean, just drying them, you know. I mean, you know, December is not a time when you would eat tomatoes seasonally, right? But you can just dry them, and then you can eat dried tomatoes. Do you know what I mean? So, yes, but I do agree with that. It does make sense to me. I mean, it especially makes sense because this whole thing about, you know, eating greens in summer, green is the color related to summer, you know, eating darker foods in winter, eating, Green isn't summer, Green Spring, my apologies. Eating green food in spring, eating red foods like all the fruits and berries and stuff like that, which comes out in the summer, right? So eating seasonally, it goes along with these recommendations. You know, it's quite easy to do. Your white pungent foods are more available this time of year overall than they are any other time of year, and same for each other category. So eating seasonally is kind of built into the whole downward system. But I wouldn't get too hung up on it. Now, having said that, like, that's my theory, but my practice is almost everything I eat is seasonal now, because I live in Portugal right now, and in this kind of climate, everything is in season pretty much all the time. That's not quite true, but almost everything I eat now is local. I mean, it's all grown, like, within hiking distance, which is cool. But I wouldn't want to limit, like, if I were to live in northern Scandinavia, I wouldn't want to limit myself to that, you know, and, you know, ditto for some areas of the world. So, I mean, even in Britain, you know, a lot of people talk about, like, eating a vegan kind of diet in the winter in Britain. What does that leave you with? Not a lot, you know. Kale. what else, you know? You could probably count it on your hands. I mean, there's some wild food as well, of course. But it's not a very varied diet. So, like, eating seasonally, eating locally, I think that depends partly on the climate that you're in as to how feasible that is. And, you know, for many of us who come from these extreme northern and southern hemispheres like our ancestors, life was a hardship, partly because it was, like, there's so much that wasn't available in certain seasons, particularly winter, right? So, you know, I mean, like, our ancestors struggled and suffered to get us to a point where, you know, creating trade routes and going off and conquering other countries and all the rest of it, partly just so that we wouldn't have to struggle and suffer throughout winter. So to me, it seems a little bit silly to kind of take a step backwards and limit ourselves to that, you know, and only eat, like, animal foods and kale in winter, for instance, in the north of Britain. But, you know, within reason, as much as it is possible, as much as it is, you know, suitable, yes, definitely. You don't want to also freak your body out with a load of stuff that it wouldn't have, like, if it weren't for the industrial revolution, you know? Like, if we weren't able to fly things from halfway across the world, we wouldn't want to base our diet around that and, like, have that be the main thing we eat. I totally believe that as well.
I think that's such a massively awesome point, actually, the no dogma guide to seasonal eating. And going back to what you were saying, if our ancestors, or, you know, even my grandmother, what she would have done in the summer, she would have been preserving. She would have been making things to keep her going through the winter, because, as you say, there just isn't that much about. So I think, you know, some people can get hooked on, well, I have to eat seasonal, but really that always comes with some caveats. So I think that's just such an awesome point, Elwyn.
Thank you. Yeah, you know, seasonally but carefully. I mean, just thinking of beans or grains or any of that kind of thing, you know. I mean, does that mean we only consume those, like, when they would naturally harvest or ripen at this time of year? Well, maybe. Maybe that would actually be better for us in the case of grains and beans. But the question is always, well, what do we eat then, you know? And so, yeah, we have to be a bit sensible about this.
Well, yeah, I wanted to ask you, actually, about grains and beans and stuff. If we are going to include them in our diet, is there anything we should do with them, or, you know, can we just put them dry into our soups or our stews?
That's a leading question, I think.
It's a very leading question.
Yeah, okay, let's talk about this. So, anti-nutrients. Again, this is covered in a lot of detail in Taoist Health Academy. Really all of the, you know, we're not trying to, you know, pitch anything to you. I know a lot of you who are already listening to this may already be a member, so I encourage you to refer back to Taoist Health Academy for a more detailed explanation. But basically, yeah, in a nutshell, so anti-nutrients. What are anti-nutrients? Anti-nutrients are things in particular food groups, especially, and particularly, grains, beans, nuts, and seeds. They all contain, with maybe one or two exceptions, but almost all of them contain these constituents which actually are there to prevent that plant from being overeaten by animals like us, and which block our absorption of nutrients and can create all kinds of digestive upset within us, can even create quite serious nutritional deficiency within us, and for a few unlucky people, can create severe intolerant or allergic reactions within us, right? So what we need to do is to prepare our, especially seeds, grains, beans, and nuts, so that we remove those anti-nutrients which can cause all these medium to serious problems. And so there's different ways to do that, but in a nutshell, we're talking about A, soaking, B, sprouting, C, fermenting, and D, cooking. Now, for me, if I have a grain or a bean, I will actually do all of those. So I won't do one or the other, because my digestion is pretty sensitive because of being abused pretty badly with a, like, latte and pizza and, you know, cigarette-only diet for 15 years. It's taken me a while for my digestion to recover. So my digestion isn't like anything that's, like, dodgy. So for me, like, if I were to get, I don't know, like, some beans and just soak them and sprout them and try and eat them, that's not pleasant. And I think I'm not the only one. There's a lot of people who just eating, like, a soaked, sprouted bean wouldn't agree with them. I think there's a lot of people who maybe they don't realize it, but just taking a grain like rice or quinoa or whatever and just, you know, putting it in water, or even soaking it for a few hours, putting it in water and cooking it and then eating it, is not going to agree with them. So I'll give a couple of examples. So these days, if I eat a nut, like a pistachio nut, which I love at the moment, really loving, what do? I put it in water, I soak it, I rinse it, I soak it again, and until it kind of starts bubbling, so fermenting, and then I soak it again, and then I dehydrate it, which is kind of like cooking it, but without damaging the fats, right? So that's like a simple version. If I were to make quinoa, I would soak it, rinse it, soak it, rinse it, and by then it would be sprouting. I would then let it bubble, ferment, and then I would cook it thoroughly, and I would rinse it again after I've cooked it, right? And every time I did that, I would be removing more of those anti-nutrients, more of those constituents which would prevent me from digesting particular important nutrients like calcium, like phosphorus, which, especially if you're a vegan or vegetarian, often you can get into trouble with that, a lack of phosphorus, which is literally like the building block for energy, ATP, so it is important. So that's what I do with, say, quinoa. One more example, if I eat beans, like say I've got a black bean stew going at the moment, I would soak, rinse, soak, sprout, then continue to leave it until it actually starts fermenting. I might add some kombucha to it to help it ferment a little bit more quickly, and if it were a grain, but I wouldn't do that with a bean, because with a bean it kind of hardens them and makes them impossible to cook. Then I would cook it thoroughly, and then I would rinse it thoroughly before I ate it. So, you know, some people would say, oh, well, you're removing the enzymes or whatever. That's the kind of raw food perspective, right? So it's going to be harder to digest. So everyone has to test that in the lab of their own body. Mm. My personal experience is that if I were to just sprout it and do all that and not cook it, then the weight of my body having to deal with those anti-nutrients is a lot worse than not having the enzymes, right? So, like, if I have to choose between having large amounts of anti-nutrients and large amounts of enzymes, or having no anti-nutrients and no enzymes, my body is much better off with the second option, right? Your body may be different, but that's certainly worth testing. Irrespective of anything else, even if you don't want to cook anything, I would say it's really, really important to do those other steps I mentioned, right? So still soak, still rinse, still sprout, still ferment, even if you don't want to cook, because you've got to get rid of those anti-nutrients. And when you look at all these cultures throughout the world, who, you know, like their staple food is some kind of grain or some kind of bean, they all do this. They all have these extensive and elaborate rituals, often going on a week or even two, of everything that they do to prepare that staple grain or staple food, staple bean, you know, whatever, before they'll eat it, right? The idea of just, like, soya. Soya is a classic example. I mean, soya these days is best avoidable in general because of GMO and all the rest of it. And because of the way our bodies are, like, over estrogened already. But, you know, the way that the soya was prepared, if you look at traditional Japanese culture, was there's a process of often months or even years before they actually eat it, you know? And then we get this idea of, oh, soy is good for you because the Japanese live a long time and they eat a lot of it. And then we just, like, literally take the bean, grind it up and eat it, like in the form of soy milk or, like, soy protein powder. And this stuff is toxic, you know, because it is not being prepared. So preparing these foods so that they're actually edible. And, you know, not only is this better in all some kind of theoretical way, which you may not be aware of, like maybe a long-term nutritional deficiency, which is something that you probably don't notice until it's too late, it's also better in the short term, like immediately. Like the way my body, I used to like barely be able to eat things like nuts or grains because like the way it would make me feel, the way it would affect my digestion. Now I've learned how to prepare these things properly. I can eat them with abandon, you know, it's fine. It's not an issue. It's enjoyable. And my body appreciates me doing that, going for that effort. So, you know, to begin with, it may sound like a bit of a hassle. I'm purposefully kind of making it sound like it's a big deal because it is. But it's one of those things that, one, you're in the habit of it. It's like a few extra minutes is no big deal. You just need to kind of be organized and be used to it. And it's a massive difference to some people in their digestion, but also all kinds of things that you may not connect to it, like your blood sugar, your mood, your energy, all of this kind of thing. Really can be a big deal.
And I mean, I don't do quite all the things that you do, but I will have like green lentils or other grains. I'll have them there sprouting, soaking, and it literally is a few minutes in the morning, maybe in the evening, and the difference that it makes when you add them to your soups or your food, I think is quite incredible if you're sensitive to those sort of things. You know, your stomach doesn't get as bloated. It's just a really big difference. And it really isn't yeah. as much work as you think. It's quite often the idea of thinking you've got to do it that is harder than actually doing it. So I totally recommend that. It's amazing.
I was almost thinking we're straying off topic here, Helen, but we're not actually, because this yet another factor is that when you do this, your body's much less likely to be constipated, which kind of comes full circle to almost our first point, right? So I'm glad that we've gone through this. It is worth mentioning because in the end, I mean, you know, not many of us are just going to eat a diet of pure salad or pure meat. In the end, we're going to eat these kind of foods, right? We're going to eat grains. We're going to eat pulses. So we need to know how to deal with them. This is important stuff. Mm. And for anyone who's listening to this and is like, oh, it sounds a bit far-fetched, I don't know. I mean, the truth is that if your digestion is very strong, and particularly if you've got very good microbiome, which we've talked about, you know, for quite a few years, you can eat these foods that have not been properly prepared. And if your microbiome is really good, the beneficial organisms inside you will kind of be able to deal with those anti-nutrients and kind of make them, what's the word, disable them for you, right? So it's true, not everyone has to do this. If you're fortunate or if you've been at this a long time and you've built a very strong, healthy body and digestive system, then you may be able to get away with not doing this kind of thing. But I would assume that you need to do this until proven otherwise. So what I'd recommend you do is try this, you know, whether it's for a week, it may be even better for a month. Just say, okay, when I eat, I'm gonna make sure this food is, you know, as thoroughly prepared as possible, and see what difference it makes.
Test it out in the lab of your body, which is something I love that you say, Elwin. So yeah, we've given people, you know, there's a lot of information here, and test it in the lab of your body. But it is just really great to be aware that the energy of the seasons are changing, that they can affect you. So to look out for dryness, for dampness, for anything that indicates, yeah, your lung organ system might need some support. And then you can reference back to this interview and there will be ways to support yourself. So hopefully this is a really empowering interview for you. Is there anything you'd like to add, Elwin?
Yeah, this is kind of part one of a training on the lungs. And so we focused mainly on the large intestine today, which is an aspect of the lungs, because that corresponds more to food, and this one is about eating. We're going to do a training next week on the importance of the lungs in relation to energy, which is also really, really important. So energy, stress, anxiety, tension, all of those kind of things we're going to be talking about in detail. So if you would like to have less stress, or better, be able to sleep better, be able to rest better, If you would like to have more energy, more consistent energy, more motivation, more drive, all that kind of thing, we'll be discussing that and how it relates to the lungs next week. So make sure you pay attention to that.
That sounds great, Elwin. So thank you very much for listening. And if you've got any comments, any feedback, please let us know under the interview, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.